Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Norcross. This is our Fox Weather Tracking the Tropics podcast number 5 of the 2022 hurricane season. Coming up on today's episode is Dr. Ben Kirtman, a professor and research scientist at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmosphere, and Earth Science. That's the first time I've said that new name. They just added Earth Science in the name. So we're not calling it Rasmus anymore, I guess, just Rosenstiel. For now. So Ben teaches graduate courses in the general circulation of the atmosphere at Rosenstiel, classes on El Niño La Niña and the ramifications of that, and climate prediction and predictability. He heads up a large-scale project called SubX that's designed to predict big weather events 3 and 4 weeks in the future, and other projects to try and predict much further out than that. And we'll talk about artificial intelligence, in other words, machine learning, and how that might help and change how we forecast the weather at long time frames in the future, plus lots of other interesting stuff. My conversation with Dr. Ben Kirtman is coming up in just a moment. I'm recording this on Monday, August 1st, 2022. Can you believe it's actually August already? And here we go with hurricane season. Well, as of today, the tropical Atlantic continues to be covered with dry and dusty weather, so the July pause in tropical activity will continue into August, which is kind of nice. This isn't wildly weird or in anything like that. It will get weird if it continues past the middle of the month. By then, we'll start thinking that something really different is going on. But on average, the third named storm comes along on August 3rd. It's only August 1st, so this is not something strange. Although it is fair to note that the Atlantic storms this far have been pretty lame. On average, though, most of the vast majority of tropical activity comes after the middle of August. And generally, we define the active part of the hurricane season as being August 20th to October 20th. There certainly have been some exceptions to that. Hurricane Charley, which hit just north of Fort Myers in Punta Gorda on Florida's southwest coast on August 13th, 2004. Many of us remember that. That comes to mind. So that was a little before that August 20th to October 20th window. But it's still not that far out. Nothing appears in the offing this week. So we'll just see what happens as we get toward the middle of the month and see if the things that normally come into play, which make the tropics more conducive to activity, actually come into play this year. The thing that is unusual this year is the amount of activity that's been developing in the eastern Pacific off Mexico. 6 hurricanes have developed, and fortunately, they've moved out to sea, although the leftovers from the latest one, Hurricane Frank, might pump some tropical moisture into the San Francisco Bay Area and Northern California. And that'll be something a little different, although I used to forecast the weather in San Francisco, and occasionally we did get tropical moisture up that far north, but certainly no hurricanes or tropical storms. There's also a tropical storm Georgette out there. It's very strange to have all this activity in the Pacific, the Eastern Pacific, in a La Niña year. I talked to Ben Kirtman about that last week because he's kind of a La Niña, El Niño specialist. But at that point, there had only been 5 hurricanes that had developed. So we'll hear what Ben had to say here in just a moment. So let's take a break, and I'll be back with my conversation with Professor Ben Kirtman from the University of Miami in just a moment.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So you're best known, I think, as an atmosphere and ocean guy, how they interact and so forth. So how did you get interested in that in the first place? As I think back, I think we used to think of both the ocean and the atmosphere as two separate systems back in the day.
Yeah, actually, I got interested in this because I grew up in Southern California, and every time there was an El Nino, my parents' house had a basement, very rare where I grew up, but it was below the water table. And so when there was an El Nino, the basement would flood. And when the basement flooded, somebody had to pump out the basement, and it was a mechanical pump, and so you had to babysit it. So what's your teenage son for other than to babysit the pump for you, right? You have to get up in the middle of the night every half hour, go to sleep for another half hour, so when there was a big El Nino, I was the pump sitter. And so it just got me really interested in this question. Where did this El Nino thing come from? What is it? And so I got interested in that problem in high school. And when I went to college, my interest peaked and on to graduate school.
Yeah, and so what was your PhD subject and where did that lead you?
So my PhD was in ocean and atmospheric science, but I originally started in applied math. And so I was really interested in, you know, bringing a mathematical perspective to the problems of how the ocean and the atmosphere talk to each other. And so that's what I worked on in my thesis, and that's what I've been working on for the last 30 years.
And where'd you go to school, and how'd you end up in Miami?
So I went to school at the University of Maryland. They had a real good department, and someone that was really getting interested and excited about these coupled ocean atmosphere kind of problems, this guy named Shukla. And so I worked with him, and then I stayed in the DC area and was a faculty at George Mason. And someone at Miami came calling, and it was an excellent opportunity. It's a great program at the University of Miami, great students. And so I was excited to join the faculty there.
Yeah. So there are a lot of things to talk to you about, but let's start with the ENSO, or what everybody normally knows is El Nino and La Nina, the warming or cooling of the tropical Pacific along the equator, basically kind of south of Hawaii. Feels like we know a lot more about El Nino, La Nina now than we did, say, 20 years ago. But can we start at the basics? Does the atmosphere, in other words, the wind, cause El Nino or La Nina, or do the ocean temperatures cause the wind, or is that a chicken and egg question?
It's a chicken and the egg question. It's a coupled phenomenon. The two systems talk to each other. They work together to produce an El Nino. The simplest explanation is to think about it this way. Suppose the ocean surface temperatures get a little bit warmer. What that tends to do is tends to weaken the winds along the equator. When those winds weaken, the ocean temperature gets warmer. When the ocean temperature gets warmer, that makes the winds weaken more. The winds weakening more makes the ocean temperature warmer. So it's this coupled feedback between the two. Weaker winds, warmer temperatures, weaker winds. So it's a sort of a circular argument, but that's the nature of coupled processes. And that's why we get El Nino.
And then the water gets warmer because the winds don't churn up the water so much. So if you have strong winds, you get more, you know, there's
exactly.
A colloquial term, churning of the water, right? Or
exactly.
Overturning of the water.
That's
so
right.
The weaker winds mean warmer water.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for filling that in. Well, you know, your intuition about the ocean is probably right. The surface is warmer and it gets colder as you go with depth. If the winds are really strong, it mixes up that cold water. If the winds weaken, it's no longer mixing up that cold water to the surface. And that's how there's the two processes talk to each other.
So just to try and be clear for somebody that, that really doesn't study this, and be sure that I interpret this right. So the simple version is that when the Pacific trade winds, the winds that are blowing from our part of the world over toward Asia, when they're strong, it kind of blows the warm water to the other side of the Pacific, and that allows the cold water on our side to come to the surface closer to South America, and the surface of the Atlantic gets cool, to upwell, so to speak. But when then the cold water on our side, and there's warm water on the other side. So that's a La Nina. That's kind of sort of like we have right now. But if the trade winds are weak, and then, like you said, that warms the water on our side of the Atlantic, or our side of the Pacific, and that's the El Nino thing.
Right.
So the La Nina that we're experiencing right now, where there's kind of a weak La Nina, mm-hmm. meaning there's cool water, but not mm-hmm. super cold water, compared right. to long-term temperature averages. Why are some La Ninas or El Ninos weaker or stronger?
It's a great question, and I'll tell you, Brian, we don't really know exactly what determines the strength of El Ninos and La Ninas. And part of the reason we don't really have a great explanation is these couple processes are really complicated. And other things happen that can affect this, how the ocean and the atmosphere talk to each other. Things that can come in from the extratropics, big cold surges into the tropics, for example, or how the monsoon, the Indian summer monsoon, oscillates up and down. So we don't actually have a very good explanation of what determines the amplitude of a cold event, a La Nina, or a warm event, El Nino. The debate really rests on, at this moment in time, really rests on two things. There's stuff going on below the surface of the ocean. And so one hypothesis is it's the magnitude, the strength of that stuff that's going on below the surface of the ocean. And there are others that argue that, no, it's a higher frequency. It's what we call the Madden-Julian oscillation, or a variability on faster timescales that's kicking the system so that it gets bigger or smaller in certain ways. So we don't actually know. That's an area of very active research.
And essentially, the atmosphere doesn't behave in lockstep with the ocean, right? So the atmosphere is kind of doing its thing to some degree, and that mm-hmm. affects the ocean. So you can't, I guess, rely on the ocean to just have one cycle, because the atmosphere is always interacting with it.
Right. And so that's a perfect explanation. You got it dead on. There's part of the atmosphere that we say is coupled. It's this tight coupling between the ocean and the atmosphere. There's a lot of stuff going on in the atmosphere that's not coupled, that's uncoupled variability. How is that knocking the system around? How is it banging it around and making it do different things? That's the really hard part. We don't fully understand that. We have some ideas, but we don't fully understand that.
So is this year's La Nina, looking in where the cooler water is there in the Pacific, is it different somehow, like more south of the equator than normal or something? Because we've had so many Pacific storms, and we've had 5 hurricanes in the eastern Pacific this year so far. And normally in a La Nina year, you don't get a whole lot of eastern Pacific tropical activity, because the water tends to be cooler than normal, right? But when I look at the distribution of where the water is warm and the water is cool, it looks like there is this warm pool off of Mexico where these storms seem to be forming, and the cold water seems to be, to my eye, farther south. What's your analysis?
The cold water is further south. I mean, every La Nina is different. Certainly this one is quite a bit different, and I think you're seeing a lot of competing things. So one, yes, the water has shifted perhaps a little bit further south than we normally have. It's giving an opportunity for more warmer water to develop further north. You tend to get some north-south contrast, or if it's cold at the equator, it gets a little warmer to the north. You see things like that happen. So we're seeing some of that contrast develop. But also, there's the component of a changing climate going on at the same time. The whole climate system seems to be warming up. And that, so it's sort of complicating all of these processes all at the same time. So, you know, one could ask, are we seeing some signatures of climate change or climate warming and some of these changes in the hurricane statistics? Is it directly connected to La Nina? So there's some issues there that need to be resolved.
Yeah, so I was actually going to ask you about that right now. Is it fair to say that in the warmer world, we can't necessarily look at past El Niños and La Niñas and the way the climate and ocean systems interacted and say, okay, it's going to act like that again, because we have a huge forcing variable here in the warming atmosphere and warming oceans.
Yeah, I think it's fair. It actually comes down to a really simple point and tells you that we really have a lot of work to do still in terms of understanding things. We actually don't know what El Niño will look like at 2100. We use our models to try to estimate that, but our models are giving very different answers. And that's because each model has different processes that it thinks are most important in terms of El Niño. So there might be a whole suite of processes. Each model is different. It's giving El Niños for different reasons. And so we don't actually have a clear picture of what El Niño is going to look like at the end of this century when the climate is significantly warmer. That's, an area of active research, and really just shows you that, you know, we understand climate change on really large scales, continental scales, global scales, but when you start getting down to regional phenomenon and the natural variability, we have a long way to go. There's a lot we need to learn.
Isn't part of that the dramatic aspect of climate change that we see is in the Arctic, and it's more subtle in the tropics, although you do then affect the temperature contrast between the Arctic and the tropics. And so since the tropical differences are somewhat more subtle, and maybe that temperature difference really affects the atmosphere more than it affects the tropical ocean, you have a lot of different kinds of interactions going on there
Exactly. We have these steep contrasts between the north and the south. Like you mentioned, the warming tends to be amplified in the Arctic. That's reducing the pole to equator temperature gradient. Mm-hmm. That's affecting the strength of the trade winds at the equator that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's one possibility that those trade winds would weaken and we'd sort of enter in sort of a permanent kind of El Niño state, where maybe there isn't big oscillations anymore. And others argue that, well, in this sort of quasi-permanent El Niño state, you get bigger oscillations. And our models give us all kinds of different answers, in part due to that change from how the temperature contrast between the equator and the tropics is actually, the equator and the extratropics is actually getting weaker. Mm-hmm. That temperature contrast is different. And that temperature contrast drives so much phenomenon. Weather is intimately connected to that contrast between the equator being warm and the poles being cold. If you warm up the poles, you're going to change the distribution of weather too. It's a tricky problem.
The nature of the jet stream, as a matter of fact, there are a lot of people that think that this extremely wavy jet stream is giving us this extreme weather, heat way up into Canada and very heavy rains and systems that don't move very much, and all that is related to this temperature contrast change that we've seen.
That's right. And so we have a fundamental clear understanding of what's happening to that north-south temperature contrast. Where we start to break down and not do as well, or we have a lot of work to do, is what are the implications? How does that impact hurricanes? How does that impact wet day-to-day weather? How does that impact El Niño? That's the part that remains open science questions. What does it do to the natural variability? How does it change extremes that we're seeing? So that's where the challenging science is, and that's what's exciting.
Yeah, there was a time not long ago, I think, that the consensus was that in a warmer world, we'd see fewer hurricanes but stronger hurricanes, and that was really because the climate models were indicating a more frequent El Niño. My sense is that, as you say, there's been some divergence in the research about this, and there are some people that think, no, actually, we'll actually not have more frequent El Niños necessarily, or the climate state will still support plenty of hurricanes, and maybe there won't be this lowering of the numbers, because El Niños, when you have warm water in the Pacific, the air rises in the Pacific, and it flows across the Atlantic and creates a less hospitable environment in the Atlantic for storms to develop. So the idea was fewer storms would develop, but maybe that's not as clear if I understand the current research.
Yeah, that may not be as clear. We just don't know. Certainly the preponderance of evidence right now, as you mentioned, is that we're going to see more intense storms, more intense category 3, 4, and 5. Whether there's going to be a total reduction in the number of storms, I think that remains an open question. But I think the preponderance of evidence, I would say likelihood, but it's not nearly as confident we are as the Arctic warming, let's say. But there is increased likelihood of more category 3, 4, and 5 storms. There's increased water vapor in the atmosphere as the atmosphere warms. So that seems to suggest that these storms might produce more rainfall than they have in the past. And there's some evidence that you actually mentioned that the forward speed of these storms has decreased also as a result of climate change. But all of those hurricane effects, we have less confidence in those statements, in part because how climate change affects the natural variability is really tricky still. We have a lot of research to do.
And let's take a quick break. I'll be back with Dr. Ben Kurtman in just a moment.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Well, you know, you talked about your experience in Southern California, and everybody that lives there is very familiar with strong El Nino years and the rain.
Yes.
and so forth. So we know that El Nino and La Nina and what the state of the Pacific is affects the global circulation. It has effects not just in California, but has effects in Florida and across the South and in the North, everywhere, right? So having that big pool of cold water or warm water there just puts energy in a different way into the global circulation. So you end up with different patterns on average. Is that fair?
Yeah, actually, I like the way you put it. You have this big blob of warm water, this big blob of cold water in the tropical Pacific, and it disrupts where the weather patterns go. So it's sort of moving energy from one place to another. That's a really clean way to, I think that's a very simple but accurate way to think about it. I think that's exactly right. One of the biggest, most robust signals associated with El Nino is wintertime rainfall over Florida, as a matter of fact. So when, even more so than California. So when we have an El Nino, we expect more winter rainfall over Florida. And when we have a La Nina, we expect less winter season rainfall over Florida. And that's perhaps one of the most robust relationships associated with El Nino and La Nina outside the tropics.
So some of your work, and maybe a lot of your work, I don't know percentage-wise, but is talking about seasonal predictions and you know, how they relate to El Nino and La Nina, how the winter is going to turn out. Does that really come down to forecasting El Nino or La Nina and how it's going to be present? Or is it something, or are there many more parts to it, and that's just one component?
That's one component, but it is the big dog. To be fair, it is the big dog. However, when you start talking about more regionalized aspects, you know, what's going to happen for rainfall this coming winter season in Florida or in California, whatever, you do have to start to consider the other important processes. So in the West, snow cover is intimately linked to how much, you know, their climate variability. If you have reduced snow cover, then the land heats up and you get different kind of responses. So what happens in land surface interactions becomes an important component of that seasonal prediction problem. So seasonal prediction, the work that we do, it taps into the El Nino-La Nina phenomenon, but it's holistic. We're trying to predict the entire state of the climate system at any moment in time going forward up, say, out to a year or something like that. So we include all the processes. Sea ice is important in the Arctic. The land surface processes is important. This phenomenon that occurs on higher frequency timescales, the Majorana Oscillation, that also interacts constructively and can destructively interfere with the signal associated with El Nino. So we need to grapple with that also.
Just to be sure we're clear on that, that's this kind of pulse that goes around the tropics every month or two that can enhance or suppress tropical activity. And it's just a part of the atmospheric system, one of the things that makes forecasting more difficult, one of the elements of forecasting.
And so not only does El Nino and La Nina affect hurricanes, but also this Majorana Oscillation. So it can pass through in the Atlantic in its what's called active phase. It might give you a burst of 2 or 3 weeks where the hurricane activity really increases, or it might come through in its passive phase and suppress hurricane activity during the hurricane season for every 2 weeks. And so that interaction between this higher frequency and the lower frequency El Nino, getting our hands around that is tricky stuff. There are times when our models do a really good job and we have a lot of confidence in our forecasts, and there are times when our forecasts fail.
So how far in advance can you make general predictions about the nature of a certain season, a hurricane season or a winter season or any other time of year? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is there a horizon that you can't see past?
The story I tell is I get phone calls to this day. Someone's going to call me and they're going to say, well, I'm getting married in October 15th. Is it going to rain? I'll get a phone call like that. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell them, no, I can't tell you if it's going to rain October 15th, but I could tell you generally if October is more rainy. So I can tell you the chances of a wet October or something like that. But only the 15th, I can't tell you if it's going to rain the 15th. Mm-hmm. And it's like that. To say how far out we can predict into the future, we have to make an assessment of what are we predicting. So if I'm predicting the monthly mean or the average over the month of October for rainfall over the U.S., we think we can predict somewhere around 9 to 12 months in advance. Mm-hmm. If I'm predicting the 2 week average rainfall, then I can't quite do it as much in advance. If I'm going to predict the daily rainfall for October 15th, then the best I can probably do is October 2nd or 3rd. So, just a few days lead time, 2 weeks or something like that. So it depends what we're predicting, what kind of phenomenon we're taking. So when we talk about seasonal prediction of hurricanes, what we're talking about is, can I tell you that this hurricane season is going to be more active or less active? Might be able to say, the chances are increased for more landfall hurricanes, but that's a little fishy. We're not sure about that yet. But that's the kind of things that we talk about seasonal prediction. And so if I was thinking about hurricane season, I would say, okay, guys, if I can make a forecast in something like March, April, May for the coming hurricane season about whether it's going to be above normal or below normal, that's a pretty good forecast.
Mm-hmm. And you have this big project you've been working on called SubX, right?
Yes.
It's sub-seasonal within a given season. And is that a 3 to 4 week forecast? Is that right? Do I have that right?
That's right. So the SubX problem is really historic. This is a fundamental change in the climate prediction community in that we thought this time scale, what's going to happen 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks from today, we thought that was going to be impossible forever. But we've had some breakthroughs, and we think we can actually make some progress. So this SubX project that we're running, you can think about it as, this hurricane season, we're suggesting it's going to be a more active hurricane season. That's the forecast. And that's largely based on La Nina. Mm-hmm. But as we go through the hurricane season, can we say 2 weeks out, look, we're about to enter a really active period, a really active hurricane period? That's what that SubX project is about. Can we capture the higher frequency phenomenon that sits on top of this lower frequency, slower moving El Nino, La Nina phenomenon, and how that impacts our weather and climate? So that's really what the SubX project is driving at. And it leverages this Madden-Julian oscillation, just like the seasonal problem leverages El Nino. This Madden-Julian oscillation is a big part of what we leverage in this higher frequency forecast.
Yeah, I was just writing about this, actually, that we're in an enhanced phase of the Madden-Julian oscillation over the Atlantic. We saw this coming, right? But there is so much dust and other factors, right? So it's a battle between wind shear dust in the negative and an enhanced phase of Madden-Julian in the positive. And all the computer forecast models say that the dust and the rest of it is going to win. And this enhanced phase is going to move on. And interestingly, from a timing standpoint, we might get a suppressed phase going into August for at least, you know, some part of when we expect tropical activity to generally begin in August. So you have all this stuff going on kind of in different levels. And I guess what you're trying to do is see what lines up, right?
Or
what
lines exactly. What constructively interferes, and you're identifying a lot of the destructive interference, right? The dust loading is destructively interfering with the Madden-Julian oscillation signal and the La Nina signal. And this is the profound challenge that we have. And so, you know, a couple of months ago, we were, you know, announcing this active hurricane season. And, you know, as of now, we haven't seen that big activity. And so, you know, we have to be able to explain why. We have to be able to forecast that, you know, this, you know, possibility that even though some of the big forcing signals indicate increased activity, we could end up with a less than normal hurricane season because of the dust loading and the timing of the Madden-Julian oscillation. These are the things we have to be able to predict, because otherwise people are going to lose confidence in our forecasts. And so we really need to work hard to make sure we can capture this phenomenon.
In weather world, I hear, you know, people throwing around 2013. So 2013 was a year when the seasonal predictions were kind of uniformly bad, right? It just didn't happen, and it wasn't obvious why it wasn't happening.
Right.
I mean, it's too early to commit to that by any means. It's not even August yet, as we're recording this here. So, but you know, as somebody who looks ahead and does want to do these seasonal forecasts, I mean, does this situation make you a little nervous here?
I think there's a real concern. My concern is the dust is going to clear out, mm-hmm. and the La Nina signal is going to dominate, you know, start to really kick in, mm-hmm. Probably late August, early September, maybe even, you know, pushing into late September. And so I think we're going to see a flourish, a blooming of the hurricane season, perhaps late in the hurricane season, you know, late September, something like that. My concern is that people will be a little bit complacent because it's a slow ramp up. And so, okay, maybe it'll be a weak year. But I wouldn't be surprised if late in the season we see a blooming of hurricane activity.
We've certainly seen it go both ways, right? We've seen it where suddenly the season stopped, like a super busy season. Was it 2004? That was just crazy. Is that the one? I think.
I think it
shut off. Well, last year.
Last year is a good example. Yeah.
Last year we got to October, and that was essentially early October, and that was it. And it was bang, bang, bang at a record rate before that. But then we've seen it the other way too, where it's started late and then gone full force, or there's been a big gap where there's nothing that's happened, and then it's all come back. Even in 2005, it wasn't like it was steady through the season. That was the Katrina, Rita, Wilma year. It wasn't steady. There were these gaps where we actually thought maybe there would be a break, and then once it started in late August, then it was steady. Then it was
right.
Crazy for the next 2 months.
Right.
So that happened.
So it's kind of funny because you do these forecasts, and there's a part of you, you know, I have a house in Florida, so I hope I'm wrong mm-hmm. at times. So it's kind of a weird thing, but yeah.
Let's take a quick pause. We'll be right back on the Fox Weather Tracking the Tropics podcast in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
So do I have it? I have it right that, basically what you're trying to do is determine when the atmosphere and ocean system is conducive to storm hurricane development or in winter forecasts, some other aspect, extra cold, extra warm, extra wet, something like that.
Exactly.
So you're trying to find, you know, these set of factors that make it conducive to a certain outcome and identify them, right? Is that?
That's right. That's exactly right. So instead of in the modeling world, I use these complex computer models that we think capture how the ocean and the atmosphere talk to each other, all the physical phenomenon, holistically, all of the things. So I don't have to have any preconceived notions about what's important at this moment in time and what isn't. The hard part there is developing these models, making sure these models start with a good estimate of what the state of the climate system looks like so they can march forward in time. These models are very complex, and precisely how do you use them is very tricky. So the example in the hurricane community is, right, you have this plume of spaghetti diagrams, people sometimes call them, these plume of hurricane forecasts, a bunch of different models. They're the same problem in the seasonal prediction community. We have challenges initializing these models. We have different models that give different forecasts. How do we combine them? So the way I tell people what I do is I try to glean the best possible guidance on what the climate system will look like in the future, given multiple flawed tools.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, that's fair. Is there an artificial intelligence component to this? I mean, it seems like every problem we try and solve these days, we solve it with some kind of machine learning, artificial intelligence, something like that.
Yeah, so we're starting to bring that that machine learning stuff to bear on the seasonal forecast problem, but it's in its infancy. It's turning the problem on its head in a really nice way. So when you and I were talking about things, we were talking about specific phenomena. We were talking about how El Nino and La Nina affect things, how the Madden-Julian oscillation affects things, how dust affects things. The machine learning approach, the data science approach, is agnostic in terms of phenomena. It says, just give me all the raw data and let's let the machine figure out what's important. So it's a really different different approach. It's also tricky too, because you can make lots of mistakes when you think about what data you decide to give to the machine, how the machine trains on that data, what kind of implicit rules are you incorporating. So it's still tricky business, but it's a different approach. It's saying, let's let the data drive the answer instead of how I think I understand the climate system. So it's a different approach. And I think the combination of the two is what we're looking for to give the best possible forecast.
Yeah, on YouTube, you can see people that are showing examples of amazing things that some kind of machine is making in terms of the art it makes or something like that. But if you stray, and they try to force it to stray just outside of a certain set of parameters, it turns into something goofy, right? It doesn't.
That's right.
It doesn't get outside of its lane. Its lane can be amazingly wide when you're thinking in those terms, but as soon as you start thinking over here, it comes up with some, you know, nonsensical kind of approach, right?
This machine learning is all sort of, when you let the data drive everything, it only learns on what's happened in the past. So it only knows what's happened in the past. It's not based on first principles. And so if you want to go into the future and you might be worried that the climate system is warming and we might be going into a state that's never been observed in the past, then those machine learning models will start to go goofy, just like the art you're talking about. So you're outside the range. And so figuring out how to blend this notion of a a changing climate with this data-driven science is something that that is going to be a big challenge going forward.
So I think that's a really interesting point, because so much of what we talk about is based on normals, and so much of our understanding of the science has the caveat at the end. As a matter of fact, Dr. Phil Klotzbach and Dr. Michael Bell, as you know, at Colorado State, you know, where Bill Gray pioneered hurricane forecasting, seasonal forecasting back in the early 80s. They have in their report every month or two that they put it out, you know, assuming that the weather climate system behaves like it did in the past. You know, and I've talked to Phil about the question of, is, you know, at what point is that not a good assumption? How are we sure that that's still a valid assumption, or to what degree it's a good assumption? To me, that's an important question and a difficult to answer question. And this, you know, the whole idea of making forecasts, whether they're seasonal or weather forecasts these days, so much of what we do is based on the past.
Yes, that's a big problem, and it's also at times an advantage that the climate is changing. So, for example, over North America in the winter, we don't have really cold winters like we used to have.
Right.
We tend to have relatively warm winters. That's because it's based on this past climate, and so our forecast models are sort of taking advantage of that changing climate, because we include that process in the models, and they're always giving us 10 to warmer winters. So we're getting good forecasts because the climate system is warming. But as you said, we're coming close to the point where we're sort of entering into states that haven't been observed, and our statistical relationships are non-stationary. They're not fixed. And so we can't rely on them as much. And so that's why there's going to have to be this blending of our models that we think are based on our first principles of how we understand the physics of the system and the data of the past. And the really exciting science that's happening right now is to figure out how to bring these two things together to make a better forecast.
And, degree the warming planet affects our traditional understanding of the systems. Not understanding maybe isn't the right word, but affects the statistics based on past relationships or past systems that we've seen or past phenomena.
Yeah, exactly. And there's lots of ways to make breakthroughs here. We have some really good modeling tools that we can separate the climate change component from what's happening just internally, and we can do lots of experiments, but it's hard work, it's difficult science, and that's what we do at the university, is try to really figure out how these things are interacting. We can hypothesize and make statements, a warmer atmosphere, it's going to rain more, stuff like that, but exactly how much and where and when, and when does it matter for hurricanes, does it matter for drought and floods, and so the devil really is in the details.
Yeah, so this, which gets to the whole nomenclature issue, we used to call it global warming, which is a very true statement, but that doesn't mean warmer everywhere and can mean wetter, some places colder, some places, right? It means what I like to say is that the weather we have today would not have been the weather that we would have had if we hadn't warmed the atmosphere. It's a different weather pattern because we've put this extra energy into the whole system.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the example, I actually have a student working on this problem at the moment. What she's working on is, cold air outbreaks. So someone might say, well, climate's warming, why do you worry about cold outbreaks? Well, even if you go into the future and you look at any 30-year period, if you just look at that 30-year period, there's going to be times when it's a lot colder than normal. And society's going to have to respond to that. So colder outbreaks are always going to be a problem, going into well into the future. And so there are these, there is climate change. The system is warming, but that doesn't mean we're not going to have snowstorms. It doesn't mean we're not going to have colder outbreaks. It still means we're going to have droughts and floods and all kinds of stuff that we're going to have to deal with, and hurricanes and things like that. So you're right. The global warming doesn't mean that the weather stops happening. It just means we're shifting how that weather is working.
So the whole question of predictability has always been interesting to me in this changing system, and to what degree it's changing is an open question, I guess. So how close do you think we are to some kind of predictability limit with just picking one small slice, like hurricane tracks in the next few days? If we look at the improvement, you know, with all the general improvement in the models, and especially at days 4 and 5 in our forecasts, you look in the short term, there hasn't been that much dramatic improvement over the last few years. It kind of goes up and down. It's hard to tell whether any one improved year is a trend or it's just somewhat random. Where do you think we are in terms of predictability of these things, and how would we know? How do we know, you know, when we're at some kind of predictability limit in a chaotic system that like the atmosphere?
So you have just asked probably one of the most important and profound questions that we're struggling with today. So I can tell you what the lower bound of predictability is, and it's obvious. It's the extent to which we can predict it. So that's the lower bound. So that's easy, right?
Okay, Ben, that's a great answer.
Right, great answer, really easy. But that, you don't care about that. What you really care about is what's the upper bound? What's the ultimate limit of predictability? We think we have a pretty good idea of what that is in terms of weather, day-to-day weather fluctuation, winter storms. We think that's about 14 days or so. However, there are regime phenomenons, blocking phenomenon, or things like that, that shift weather patterns for a considerably longer time. And so there may be phenomenon that have even more predictability. And so getting at that upper bound is really, really hard, in part because we have to use our models, which we've already said that are flawed, to estimate that upper bound. So it gets tricky. You know, do you believe the model 100%? Maybe not. So getting the upper bound is really tricky. And it also depends on what. What are we trying to predict? What are we predicting? So hurricane tracks, the predictability of hurricane tracks is probably greater than predicting hurricane intensity, for example. We've made quite a bit of progress, I think, in predicting hurricane tracks. Intensity remains a struggle, but we think we can do better. If we had better data and better models, we think we can do better. So it suggests that the conventional wisdom is that we haven't hit the limit with either tracks or intensity, but we're quite a ways away with intensity.
So for example, I mean, Hurricane Ida comes to mind because it was just last year, and people in New Orleans were very surprised that there was a wobble, but we assume was a wobble as opposed to some sort of larger scale atmospheric phenomenon, something to do with the inner dynamics of the hurricane that made it just wobble in the direction of New Orleans a bit, which made the weather somewhat worse over the city of New Orleans than if it had continued on a straight path, which in South Florida, you know, a storm is heading toward Miami and it wobbles and worse weather occurs in Fort Lauderdale. You know, these are very practical issues for people that living with these things, right? And so, you know, my sense in looking at Ida and other storms that we see make these, 20 mile, you know, we call them wobbles, is that I don't expect to be able to forecast that. You know what I mean? I expect that we're always going to have some amount of slop that we have to put around the track and just admit that those phenomena we're not going to be able to model and detect and know when they're going to happen. We can say it's probably going to happen, but when is it going to happen in the track, and is it going to happen right as it's making landfall? Feels like to me a daunting proposition, and I don't even imagine being able to forecast that.
No, I agree with that. There's two points that I would want us to consider when we think about that. The first is when you look at it as a large-scale weather climate guy like myself, the track for Hurricane Ida was quite good. Yeah, several days out, right? It was a great forecast. But if you look at it as a hurricane expert or someone that's living in New Orleans, oh, God, this wobble really clobbered us, right? And so where I think the second point I want to make is that where I think we need to really push is what is the probability of that wobble? We can't actually say it's definitively going to wobble, but is there a 10% chance that it's going to do this 20-mile shift, a 30% chance, a 40% chance? Really quantitatively robust probability estimates will allow important decision makers to be able to deploy resources to respond to the storm more carefully. So we're not going to be able to say it's going to wobble, but can we say that there's a 10% chance, a 20% chance? So can we really refine those probabilities of these slight movements? That's where I think we need to be pushing.
And it becomes very, very critical for planning, because if a storm goes just north of the entrance to Tampa Bay, the water gets pushed in the bay. If it goes just south of the entrance of Tampa Bay, the water gets pushed out of the bay, right? It's a tremendously different effect on the Tampa Bay area, just that slight difference in track, which we saw with Laura a couple of years ago when it just missed Calcasieu Pass going up to Lake Charles in Louisiana. It went just to the right, so the huge surge of water that would have gone 30 miles inland didn't happen. They got, you know, blasted by the wind, but if it had gone just to the left, and it would have happened. And I think everybody understands that it is unforecastable in an absolute sense, but it is forecastable in an odds sense.
In an odd sense. In fact, you know, the scenario that you just laid out for Tampa Bay, I've had some interactions over the years with the American Red Cross, for example. And what they really worry about is that storm where the wind drives Tampa Bay inland, basically. Mm-hmm. That's where they're really concerned that the impacts would be catastrophic. And so that 10-mile, 20-mile wobble, and what are the chances of it, that's going to make a big difference in the deployment of resources for recovery and resilience in response to that storm. So you're absolutely right. But like you said, we have to do this in a probability perspective, an odds perspective. Otherwise, we're not credible, because there's odds that it won't happen, and we have to be honest about that.
Yeah, in the last podcast, I was talking to Paul Delgado, who's the chief meteorologist at Channel 13 in Tampa, and we were talking about, you know, I said, what do you talk about to people there? He said, well, we talk about the 1921 hurricane, and you know, which was the last Category 3 hurricane to put water into Tampa Bay, although in 1848 there were two, one really big one, that, you know, moved in north of Tampa Bay, and if it were to happen today, would be a devastating type hurricane. So we know it can happen.
Yes.
It really comes down, I guess, when you get down to it, as a practical matter, it comes down to a communications problem, right? It's that if we can't absolutely forecast these very small deviations that make so much difference to how people live, then we've got to motivate people to understand the odds of something happening and take action based on that.
Yeah, and I agree. It is the communications part is a big part of it, and it's fairly clear to me that the public can understand probabilities and odds. I mean, they understand gambling, they understand the stock market, they can understand these things. But we struggle to figure out how to present forecasts in a way that people can digest the odds and make well-informed decisions. So that communication problem is something that the Hurricane Center, I'm sure you're well aware of this, is grappling with all the time. The cone that they make, you know, is basically a probability assessment, and people have a lot of concerns about just how that information is communicated and how people interpret it. For example, if they're outside the cone, they assume they're safe. It's still there's still a 33% chance of the storm hitting you if you're outside the cone.
Well, so, that's just the center of the storm. Now that the cone has shrunk so much, the bad weather is always outside the cone. Now,
right. You know,
back when I started that, the bad weather was very often inside the cone, and it kind of worked, right?
That's
been, 30 years ago. So on a different predictability question. We have not been making public, or the National Hurricane Center has not been making public, 7-day forecasts for hurricane tracks, because there are enough outliers that, I guess it could damage credibility. I'm very concerned as a communicator of what happens when you tell somebody it's not going to happen and then you have to turn around and tell them it is going to happen, right? That's, you really want to avoid that, because people latch on to the, oh, it's not going to happen, I don't have to pay attention anymore. So the Hurricane Center works very hard to try and, as long as there are decent odds it's going to happen, that you keep it going. So trying to figure out how, when you know you have these potential outliers, Hurricane Florence was an example a few years ago, where the models were taking it up in the middle of the ocean, and it kept coming toward the coast, and of course hit in South Carolina, and it was a big disruptive storm. So what do you think about that issue? Because isn't it something like a kind of a bell curve? And so you have these tails, right? You always have a tail on the curve, right? And mm-hmm. The question is how you minimize the tail, and then what do you do? How do you identify when you have the odds of something occurring outside of the center of the curve of possibilities?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question that goes beyond the physical science, goes into the sociology and the communication issues. It is of critical importance to figure out to get that right. And I don't know whether a false negative is worse than a false positive, right? Which is worse? Which risk is higher? So if you give if you make a forecast and it doesn't happen, are people going to ignore the next forecast? If you miss it, if you miss it and it happens, people may lose lives and property and maybe big impact. What are they going to think about the next time the storm forecast is made? So, the impact of false positives and false negatives and how we deal with that and how we communicate that. And, what's the obligation, of the Hurricane Center to go out to longer leads? A lot of that, for people that are willing to sniff around on the internet, a lot of that forecast information is out there. You go to various websites, you can start to see forecasts that are going 2 weeks out or even longer. So for someone that really wants to dig it up, and so, there's a part of me that thinks the Hurricane Center should be the honest broker of all that information that's out there, really provide some contextual uncertainty estimates of when you should start taking these things seriously, when you should worry about the tails of the distribution. But there's also part of me that these guys are busy and they really got to focus on the immediate problem, the train that's coming in into the tunnel. Figuring out all of this stuff, I think, is stuff that needs to be done. But I do think the Hurricane Center is in this great position. It's really well respected. It really is the clearinghouse for the best hurricane information, of course. And so, going to longer leads, being that honest broker, I think is an important role for the Hurricane Center.
Yeah, I talk about this a lot, actually. The issue that we need in our society, because we have so many fewer credible voices, and the National Hurricane Center is one of the real credible voices, one of the few in our society, and I'd like to see the National Weather Service actually have a bigger voice in our society. That doesn't take anything away from private forecasters or communicators, but you do need credibility underpinning. And as the communication systems get so much more distributed, and people don't connect as much with people anymore, they connect with websites and things like that. When important information needs to be communicated, people still want to understand the credibility of the messenger, and I think that's really important.
I think so too, and it's interesting. I think there's a lot of work going on trying to understand how people take in information, who they consider the honest broker. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the example I always give is my neighbors during hurricane season, if they see me put up shutters, that's it. It's going to happen. Time to put up our shutters, right?
Yeah, Max Mayfield says the same thing, yes.
okay, so your neighbor is your honest broker, but they don't really know if I know what I'm talking about.
Right.
So we need to sort of really help people identify who are the most important honest brokers in providing the best information. And like you said, the Weather Service and the National Hurricane Center and just NOAA in general is really the organization that can take the lead in being that honest broker.
Yeah. All right, Ben, thanks so much. We'll be interested in following your research, and you're right on the cutting edge, and it's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you for having me, Brian. I really appreciate it. Nice conversation.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
I'll be right back in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
And welcome back. Well, anybody that knows me knows that Florida State is my school. I have 2 degrees from there. And at the time I got my master's, FSU was the big meteorology school in the South, and it's still a great school with a great legacy. But I've taught at the University of Miami, and I've spent time at the Rosenstiel School, which is a separate place from the main campus in a magnificent location on Biscayne Bay. For somebody who wants to study how the tropical oceans interact with the atmosphere in the real world, I can't imagine a better place than the Rosenstiel School at Miami. It'll be interesting to see how Ben's research matures going forward. As computers become more powerful and more innovative projects evolve, we'll challenge the intrinsic predictability of the atmospheric and oceanographic system, I'm absolutely sure. Be sure you subscribe to our Tracking the Tropics podcast. Our next one will be next week when we'll talk with our old friend and the new director of the National Weather Service. Ken Graham will be here. Ken took over responsibilities for the nation's weather program after a successful run as director of the National Hurricane Center and the Weather Service office serving the New Orleans area. So I'm looking forward to visiting with Ken after the big transition, and that's coming up next week. A reminder, remember to download the Fox Weather app. First, you can get your local forecast without a bunch of annoying ads getting in the way all the time, and you can watch the live stream of Fox Weather on your phone or your iPad by just clicking in the upper right. And you can watch Fox Weather at foxweather.com or on the Roku channel, YouTube TV, Amazon Fire, and lots of other streaming platforms. So I'll see you there on the Fox Weather stream when the tropics are active. And follow me on Twitter, at BNorcross, and on Facebook and Instagram, just Google Brian Norcross and you'll find me. Until next time, I'm Brian Norcross. Be well and stay informed.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.